They say it's 5 p.m. somewhere, so let's spend some time contemplating
cocktails.
Pretty
darn far east of here, but anyway, that's fine. In particular, the plants, flowers, vegetables, and seeds that your favorite libations are made of. Barley, by the way, becomes scotch. Rice becomes sake. Sugarcane is rum.
And distillers don't stop there. They add things like elderflowers, jasmine, or juniper berries to craft a more complex taste. Amy Stewart has written about wicked plants and wicked bugs. Her latest book is The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. Good morning.
Good morning.
You write in this book about going into a liquor store and having a vision of a garden in the bottles. Everywhere you turn, you don't just see the drink, but you see the grains, fruits, and flowers that have disappeared into it.
Yeah, that's right. You know, I was with some friends. We actually went out to a liquor store to get some ingredients for this drink I wanted to make for them. And throughout the whole day, because I was with a bunch of gardeners, I was talking about, you know, we as gardeners should be more interested in this stuff. I mean, look at a bottle of gin. There's nothing in that bottle that isn't a plant. And the evening wears on, and I finally said, somebody ought to write a book about this. And all my friends said, yeah, why don't you do it? You're the one who can't shut up about it.
It does sound like a perfect conversation to have when you've had a couple, actually.
Right.
Give us an example of one drink. You know, I like Manhattans. One drink and what it's made up of.
Well, I like Manhattans, too, and I'm glad to know that you're a Manhattan drinker. We have that in common. And I think, actually, that's a great example. Manhattan easily has 20 or 30 plants in it. So you can start with the whiskey, which would contain barley, rye, and wheat or corn. And, of course, it's been soaked in an oak barrel, so let's not forget that that's another plant, the oak tree, that has a huge role in cocktails. And then you add sweet vermouth, which is a wine base, so there's your grapes. And then vermouth has a lot of spices and herbs. And then you splash on some Angostura bitters, and Angostura bitters have, oddly enough, not Angostura bark, but has a lot of other roots and seeds. And the final ingredient in a Manhattan is, of course, a cherry. And so there's one more plant.
Well, tell us what plant turns up in more drinks than any other.
Well, that's a very interesting question. It's hard to figure that out. So here's my theory on this. I think that barley is very, very common because barley is in almost every kind of grain spirit around the world. And that forms the basis for not just beer and vodka and whiskey, but a lot of other liqueurs might have a grain base. But a really intriguing plant that I kind of fell in love with as I was writing this book is sorghum. Sorghum is a grain that we don't think about a lot. It's actually the fourth largest crop grown in the United States, and it's grown across Africa and used to make this homemade beer, this cloudy, opaque beer. And it's also grown across Asia, and particularly in China, where it's used to make Maotai, which is a very strong, clear spirit that is a traditional part of Chinese banquets. So I think that sorghum might actually be the plant that turns up in more alcohol around the world than any other, believe it or not.
You have a section of the book that you title Bugs in Booze. In this particular case, you're talking about earthworms.
You know, anytime you're talking about plants, bugs are not far away, right? So I kept reading reviews of scotch where they would talk about the worm flavor. And I thought, what are they talking about? Well, it turns out that it's a distilling term. As the spirit is coming out of the still, it goes through this particular kind of cooling and condensation process in this curly piece of copper tubing that they call a worm. And so scotch connoisseurs believe that they can taste the difference when that particular piece of equipment is used to make the scotch, and they call that a worm flavor. But no earthworms were harmed in the making of the scotch. I can assure you of that.
Many a college student is quite familiar with a particular use of a worm in spirits that you are very down on, and that's the gusano that's at the bottom of a bottle of mezcal or sometimes tequila. Bad idea, right?
Well, yeah, bad idea. So it's not found in tequila. By law, if you're going to put the word tequila on the label, you can't have anything in the bottle except tequila. So it's found in mezcal, and it's the larva of a pest that attacks the agave plant. But it's a gimmick. There are people in Mexico making really extraordinarily fine artisanal mezcals who would really like to see that banned because they think it reflects badly on the whole category.
Well, just a last question. If one is looking to do an unusual garnish or something particularly delicious, what might you suggest?
There is this amazing little cucumber relative. It's called Mexican sour gherkin cucumber. It's not technically a cucumber, but it's very closely related. The fruits are the size of a grape, and they're green with little white markings. So they actually look like miniature watermelons. And they taste great. They're sort of a little more tart than a regular cucumber, but they just look extraordinary. And the vines happen to be very prolific. So you do not have to be a very good gardener to be able to grow Mexican sour gherkin cucumbers.
Amy Stewart's latest book is called The Drunken Botanist, The Plants That Create the World's Great Drinks. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
And this is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Melissa Block.
And I'm Robert Siegel. The subject of President Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the Jews is complicated. It's multidimensional and it's contentious. FDR, who had been governor of New York State, won Jewish votes by landslide margins. He led the Allies to victory in World War II and defeated Nazi Germany. Among his closest advisors and strongest supporters were Jews, Felix Frankfurter, whom he named to the Supreme Court, speechwriter Samuel Rosenman, and Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau. On the other hand, FDR said little and did less on behalf of Jews trying to get out of Germany in the 1930s. He has been faulted for not diverting military resources to destroy the Nazi infrastructure of genocide, and for not pushing Britain to admit more Jewish refugees to Palestine. He's been accused, frankly, of abandoning the Jews. Well, historians Richard Brightman and Alan Lichtman have written a richly detailed account of FDR and the Jews. That's the title of the book. And it marks a revision of Roosevelt's performance, revised upward, but still with much criticism of what his administration failed to do. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
And first, you sum up FDR's record. Richard Brightman, you write that while his compromises might seem flawed, in the light of what later generations have learned about the Holocaust, Roosevelt reacted more decisively to Nazi crimes against Jews than did any other world leader of his time.
In some ways, that's a statement about Roosevelt's world and the inadequacies of other world leaders at the time. But that comparison tells us something, that the world of the 1930s and the 1940s was a very different place, and that Roosevelt had both political constraints and international constraints that we don't often think about today.
The most obvious comparison would be with Winston Churchill. You would say that FDR was more successful or more highly motivated than the British leader.
I think Churchill has the reputation of being philo-Semitic, but didn't often back it up with actions. And Roosevelt has the reputation for being unsympathetic, but in fact did a number of things behind the scenes which show at least some concern.
Alan Lichtman, FDR, the two of you write, was raised by his father, actually, not to be an anti-Semite at a time when anti-Semitism was common to his class. And he was afraid throughout all this that expressions of concern for the Jews in Europe would inflame anti-Semitism in the U.S. How much of a factor was that in what he decided to do or say about the Jewish problem?
It was an important factor both for FDR and lots of other players at the time who were concerned about an anti-Semitic backlash. Look, the 1930s and 40s were a time in America when there was a considerable amount of anti-Jewish, anti-black, and even anti-Catholic sentiment. And people were worried about upsetting the social order in America. But let me say, this is the poison of anti-Semitism, that the fear of anti-Semitism is often greater than the reality of anti-Semitism. And it was more fear that tended to paralyze key players in the 30s and 40s than necessarily the reality of anti-Semitism.
And it wasn't just FDR. Tsar, who was afraid that doing something for the imperiled Jews of Europe might inflame anti-Semitism, as the two of you write about it, he was getting mixed messages from the American Jewish community, much of which was also saying, don't rock the boat too much because it might bring down a wave of anti-Semitism upon us.
The American Jewish community was divided both over how much they could accomplish politically and how they should go about it.
The Shoah, the Holocaust, the genocidal slaughter of Europe's Jews, has relatively few American heroes involved with it, but you guys do give credit to Treasury Secretary Henry Morgenthau and his team. He decided they should take on the State Department and the War Department and do something for refugees. What happened?
Morgenthau's subordinates became convinced that the State Department or key officials in the State Department were systematically frustrating action to relieve the distress in Europe and rescue plans as well.
Why? Why did they figure they were doing that?
There was the suspicion that some of them were anti-Semitic. There was the certainty that they believed that humanitarian activity in time of all-out war was at best a distraction and at worst interfering with the war effort.
And what did they do at the Department of the Treasury?
They took the evidence to Morgenthau. They convinced him. Morgenthau then took a detailed report on the State Department's blocking action to the president, and President Roosevelt, in January of 1944, established a new body, the War Refugee Board, which saved a substantial number of lives in the last year and a half of the war.
Alan Lichtman, explain something. The great oddity to me of all this is that as there's a struggle to get the U.S. to do more about the Jews in Europe, Roosevelt is racking up Jewish votes like nobody's business. Was raised by a parent, my mother, who told me about breaking down in tears the day she heard that FDR died. He was a sainted figure to the Jews.
Jews revered FDR, voted for him more strongly than any other ethnic, religious, or economic group in the United States. And even after the camps were liberated and the horrors of the Holocaust came to be revealed, the Jews still loved FDR. But they understood his limitations. Mm-hmm. They understood he was not perfect, but they also understood how much better he was for the Jews than any political alternative in the United States, or for that matter, anywhere in the world.
That's the critical thing, that we tend today to look back and say, he didn't do this or he didn't do that. The people who lived in his world saw him against the context of who else was there, and they appreciated the fact that he was better than his predecessors and his rivals.
Well, Professors Richard Brightman and Alan Lichtman, thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Alan Lichtman and Richard Brightman are the authors of the new book, FDR and the Jews.
This week, we're marking 10 years since the start of the Iraq War. This morning, through the eyes and words of a poet.
Dunya Mikhail is her name. She was a teenager in 1980 when war broke out between Iran and Iraq. Her father was a casualty of that nearly decade-long war, not in the fighting, but for lack of proper medical care. After another war, the Gulf War, she fled Baghdad.
Mikhail had been questioned by Saddam Hussein's government, and her writing and poetry had been labeled subversive by the state media. She escaped to Jordan and then the U.S., where she made a life for herself, marrying, raising a daughter, becoming a citizen. It is to Iraq, though, that Dunya Mikhail returns. Line by line, she revisits her country, not in body, but through the vision of her poems. Good morning.
Good morning, Grené.
Let's start with a poem. It's a longer poem called I Was in a Hurry. And I think this speaks to the connection you have with Iraq, even though you have at this point been gone a very long time.
Right, Grené. Actually, this poem was the first poem I wrote when I arrived here in America. So let me read it. Yesterday, I lost the country. I was in a hurry, and they didn't notice when it fell from me, like a broken branch from a forgetful tree. Please, if anyone passes by and stumbles across it, perhaps in a suitcase open to the sky, or cancelled like a losing lottery ticket, or rising with the smoke of war, or rolling in a helmet on the sand, or stolen in Alibaba's jar, or disguised in the uniform of a policeman who stirred up the prisoners and fled, or squatting in the mind of a woman who tries to smile. If anyone stumbles across it, return it to me, please. It's my country. I was in a hurry when I lost it yesterday.
Now, that poem was written 18 years ago, 17 years ago.
Yes.
Does the loss of your country, Iraq, still feel as raw as if it was yesterday, as you write in the poem?
The way that things come to mind, I feel that they are more as fragments. They are strange. They don't come in order anymore. So the happy moments and the sad moments climb over each other. Our home in Baghdad with the roof where we would sleep in summer nights, and we would go down when we hear the sound of the siren. The simple heater in the middle of our living room was called Aladdin, and on it that pot of tea with cardamom. And I remember my father dying in front of my eyes. I remember the windows of our classrooms shaking from explosions. You know, the war was like the norm.
Several years ago, your family experienced a terrible tragedy that we seem to hear about too much, a kidnapping. And there's just a few lines in one poem in your book, Diary of a Wave Outside the Sea. You write from the position of being in America, just outside Detroit, and you get some news. Could you read those lines?
Yeah. My husband bends his head to the table and cries. His niece in Baghdad has been kidnapped. She's 20 years old. Masked men surrounded her and pulled her away from her mother's outstretched hands into a car. They were like a tsunami. Iraq is a tsunami in slow motion. I wake at night and wonder if she's alive, and if she is, what her life is like. To be in a cage of strange hands can only be a nightmare.
Your niece was kidnapped, what, 3 years ago?
Maybe 4 years ago.
Has she ever been found?
No, we didn't hear about her since then.
I'm so sorry.
It's okay.
When we first spoke in 2007, at the time you said that writing about war and loss doesn't heal wounds, that in fact it keeps them open. Do you still feel that way?
Yes, Renee, I still believe that poetry is not medicine. It's an X-ray. It helps you see the wound and understand it. We all feel alienated because of this continuous violence in the world. We feel alone. But we feel also together, so we resort to poetry as a possibility for survival. However, to say I survived is not so final as to say, for example, I'm alive. We wake up to find that the war survived with us.
With Saddam Hussein long gone, it is possible to go back, to travel there. Why have you not gone back?
Yes, a lot of people ask me this, and the way I feel towards this is really strange. I feel that I woke up from a dream, and going back to Iraq is like asking me, will I see the same dream if I go back to sleep? It is strange, but I keep contact to maybe have some trace of that old dream or experience. And I find that Iraqis all have one dream, and that is to live a normal life and to die a normal death.
Would you read one more poem for us? It's called The Shape of the World.
Certainly. If the world were flat like a flying carpet, our sorrow would have a beginning and an end. If the world were square, we would lie low in a corner when the war plays hide and seek. If the world were round, our dreams would take turns on the Ferris wheel, and we would all be equal.
Thank you very much for speaking with us, Dunya Mikhail.
Thank you very much, Renee. I really appreciate it.
Iraqi-American poet Dunya Mikhail's collections include The War Works Hard and the forthcoming The Iraqi Nights. This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Renee Montagne.
And I'm Steve Inskeep.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Scott Simon. Something suspicious is going on in 1905 Princeton, New Jersey. Children turn into stone, spouses disappear into horse-drawn carriages, snakes squirm up and down walls. Some kind of curse? But what could the good people of Princeton have possibly done to bring a curse on themselves? Joyce Carol Oates takes this question for her new novel, the latest of more than 50, we don't even have the time to read their names, in which character meets karma. Her new novel is called The Accursed. And Joyce Carol Oates, who's received the Lifetime Achievement Award from the National Book Critics Circle and the National Humanities Medal, and is, by the way, the longtime Roger S. Berlin Distinguished Professor of the Humanities at Princeton University, joins us from the studios at University of California at Berkeley. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
This novel opens with Woodrow Wilson, when he's president of Princeton, not the United States, receiving a young Latin teacher who implores him to speak out against a recent lynching that occurred nearby. But Woodrow Wilson couldn't be bothered. Is this based on something?
Oh, it's perhaps a metaphorical dramatization of many, many things that were happening. The indifference and the unconscionable blindness of the white ruling class, the so-called good Christians of the era, mm-hmm. and people like Woodrow Wilson particularly, toward the plight of African Americans, who are the objects of racist violence, is basically the subject of the novel.
Well, let me draw you out a bit on the figure. And Woodrow Wilson is one of a number of historic figures that make appearances, Mark Twain, Teddy Roosevelt, Jack London. Woodrow Wilson is the first one, and in many ways the story kind of revolves around that. I think his image among most Americans seems to be of a high-minded man, a scholar and an internationalist more than a politician, a man who was before his time. What's wrong with that view?
It's a very incomplete view. Woodrow Wilson, for his time, was considered a reformer in education. He had many ideas that at the time were considered revolutionary about education. When he came to Princeton as a president, he reformed the curriculum. But I'm looking at something different. I'm looking at the failure to respond to these pressing issues of social injustice.
Yeah. Of course, he was born in Virginia, and the attitudes towards race and segregation were something that he carried over from his childhood, I gather.
Well, that's true. Also, his attitudes toward women. He was always really jocular and negative about women's suffrage and thought it was very amusing that women wanted the vote, but of course they should not have the vote. Mm-hmm. And people ask him, well, why do you feel that way? And he said, I have no reason.
There's a whole train here in this novel of incidents and coincidence and people under threat and risk. And how is it that people begin to see it as a curse?
I imagined a very placid and upscale, very, very religious, somewhat conservative Christian community, which is Princeton in 1905-06. Mm-hmm. And I imagined the phenomenon that having completely denied this social injustice, the reality of racism, that there would be incursions from the unconscious, or incursions from, let's say, the other side. Mm-hmm. That which is denied is emerging. So I thought of this in terms of vampires and demons and these forces from the unconscious, so to speak, erupting in this plastic community, where people seem to be seeing vampires, or maybe they actually are seeing them. They're having hallucinations, or maybe these creatures are actually real. In Gothic fiction, the border between reality and surrealism is quite porous, as in our own dreams.
Mm. Made note of a line. The Reverend Winslow Slade is a major character, I guess what, former governor and Presbyterian minister. Struck by the line, it was not that God failed to give Winslow Slade the clear knowledge of what he should do, but rather God withheld from him the strength with which to do it. Is this a novel that tells the story of conscientious people that can't find their conscience?
Well, I think that's a good way of putting it. It's the sort of inextricable presence of evil in good people, which they don't acknowledge and which they try to hide. But there was one leader, moral leader at the time, and that was Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. He's a minor character in the novel, and I've written about him elsewhere. But there were people who spoke out against lynchings and racism. There just were not very many. And there were people who spoke out in favor of women's rights, just not very many.
May I ask if Princeton, present-day Princeton, the university, and or the town have registered any reaction to what you've written?
Well, I don't know about that, but Princeton today is completely different. I mean, this is more than 100 years ago. Princeton is quite integrated. Women are professors at Princeton. Women are students at Princeton. That began in the 1970s. Mm-hmm. We're in a completely new era. We have a wonderful woman president named Shirley Tilghman, which in the time of Woodrow Wilson, that would have been so extraordinary. I think Woodrow Wilson would have fainted. He would literally have fainted. He would never have believed that. And nor would anyone have ever believed that was a possibility of a black president of the United States. They would have howled with laughter. To them, that would have been completely insane. They would never have believed it. So Princeton today is very different. And people would probably feel more or less the way I feel. Today, Princeton is a liberal university, a liberal community.
Joyce Carol Oates, her new novel is The Accursed. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
So what's your first memory? You're a baby or a toddler. Maybe it's a specific experience, maybe an impression, maybe someone's face or just a kind of feeling or sense. Or maybe it's a compilation of stories over years, and maybe it's less true than you think it is. In his new book, Pieces of Light, Charles Fernyhough digs deep into the recesses of memory to figure out what shapes it, how it works, and why some things stick with us forever. He's an associate professor of psychology at Durham University in the UK. Charles Fernyhough joins us from the BBC studios in London. Welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me on.
So I'd like to start, Charles, by asking you about your first memory. I imagine you've thought about this. What is the first thing you remember?
Well, I'm on the floor of the living room in the house where I lived at the time, and I've got this toy forklift truck, and I'm pushing this thing across the carpet. But there's something really strange about this memory. It's vivid. I can imagine the quality of the light, something of the atmosphere in the room. But I'm looking at myself in the third person. Okay? I'm not looking out at the room through my own eyes.
Yeah.
I'm looking at myself as a kid in this memory. And that is one of the most puzzling things about particularly early memories. Sometimes we see ourselves in our memories as people in the third person. We don't look out through our own eyes. And this is one of the clues that psychologists get about how memory works as a reconstruction. If I was really recording and reliving an experience that I kind of recorded in my mind, I should be looking out at that room through my own eyes, but I'm not. Mm. Something's flipped around. The perspective has changed.
So it was really interesting when I read that in the book, because it's the same for me. My first memory, I'm in the house where I was growing up. I'm really little. Something kind of embarrassing has happened to me, and I remember that sense of kind of shame. But I am looking down on myself as a little kid, as a toddler. I'm not looking out through my toddler eyes. And I hadn't thought about that as a way I may have reconstructed. What does that mean? Does that mean that's not a real memory of mine?
Not necessarily. It means that something has happened, something's been reshaped. And actually, Sigmund Freud noted this when he wrote about these kinds of memories. It doesn't mean that the memory is false, but it does mean that your perspective on it has been flipped. And so really all you can say is that it's a sign that memories are reconstructions of past events. We don't record events like a video camera recording, you know, what's going on. We gather together lots of different kinds of information. We store it sometimes for decades, and then we put it all back together in the moment. We reconstruct those events from the perspective of now.
Is there any downside to that, to having a vivid imagination and constructing really detailed memories that may or may not be true, but they become part of the story we tell ourselves about the life that we've lived?
I think this is my point in the book. There's something weird going on with memory. The scientists are telling us that memory is a reconstruction, and yet we, as people, tend to stick to our old-fashioned ideas that memory works like a video camera, for example, that it just records and it files things away in mental DVDs that we can pull down and set playing. And in a way, that's not surprising, because we see memories as foundational for who we are. You know, we commonly feel that we are our memories. You know, our memories define us. So something needs to change. What I'm trying to do with this book is say, let's have a different relationship with our memories, accepting that memories are not literal representations of the past as it happened doesn't mean that we have to forget about them or start disbelieving them all, but they're shaped by who we are now. They're shaped by what we feel, what we believe, what our biases are right now.
How much of our memory do we reconstruct because of conversations we have with other people?
It may not be intentional, but it certainly happens. So some of the most interesting research that's going on at the moment concerns those social influences on remembering. So let me give you one example. There was a study done in New Zealand of pairs of twins, and what they did is they brought the twins in separately and asked them about events from the past. And they had something like 20 pairs of twins. And 14 of those 20 pairs, each twin would come up with a memory that the other one also claimed. For example, one was swinging across a river on a rope and then slipping from the rope and falling into the river. Both members of the twin pair were claiming that memory. They can't both have done it. They must. One of them must be making it up. One of them must have appropriated that memory for themselves. And we're doing this sort of thing all the time. We're shaping each other's memories all the time, and particularly in the case of parents and children. So parents are talking about the past all the time. The conversations that they have with their kids about the past turn out to be very important for those kids' later memory, but also doing things like, you know, one day packing the video camera and taking footage of the day, that, you know, the day trip or whatever, and other days not doing so.
As a new parent, that feels like a lot of pressure. Kind of a strange power to have.
I don't want to add to the list of things that parents feel guilty and anxious about. But also as couples, we're doing this all the time. I think one of the most interesting things about memory in relation to couples getting together is that there's this sense, this kind of pressure to agree on a shared representation of the past. You know, husbands and wives tend not to disagree about the past, you know, wholesale. They tend to come to a shared representation of what happened in the past. When people split up or couples get separated or divorced or whatever, those tensions about memory can come back to the surface, and you find out that people start to disagree and actually say, well, it never happened that way, it actually happened this way.
Do you think we can make our memories sharper?
Well, partly thinking about this book made me realize that remembering more stuff isn't necessarily better. Being able to recall every card in a pack of playing cards or recall pi to 1,000 decimal places. Why? Why would you want to do that? It's no use to me. For some people it might be important, but it's no use at all for me. What I would like to do is remember the stuff that I remember better, in more detail, more vividly.
And you think that's possible? That you can get better at remembering?
I don't have any strong scientific evidence to point to, but having thought a lot about how memory works, my hunch is that by paying more attention to what's going on around you, You can encode the event more fully. You can pick up more of those details that later go on to make that big, rich picture. And so you can have a more intense, a more enjoyable, if you like, a more vivid experience of that event when you come back to it. It's just trying to live the moment more intensely.
Charles Fernyhough, his new book is called Pieces of Light. He is an associate professor of psychology at Durham University in the UK. Charles, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Do you remember your first memory? Share it with us on Twitter. I am @RachelNPR.